The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Larson, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Jeannie M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As you know, we are conducting oral arguments by Zoom today. For purposes of the recording, today is December 15th, 2022. It's a snowy, wintry day. We have six cases on our calendar today, four oral and two non-oral. The first case on our calendar today is A22-099, State of Minnesota versus Merwin Andrew Coleman. As you know, each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer in the grid view, so you should be able to see your time. If we do have any technical difficulties, the marshal will stop the clock to ensure you get your full 15 minutes for argument. Also, just a quick reminder to those who are watching, there are no recordings of our Zoom oral arguments permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. But an audio recording will be available on our website, usually within 24 hours of the oral argument. So with that, we can proceed. I'll just ask the counsel, please identify yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument and let us know the correct pronunciation of your name and your client's name and how you'd like to be addressed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender and I represent the appellant in this case, Merwin Coleman. Minnesota law provides that before a district court can revoke probation, it must make three findings. First, that a condition was violated. Second, that the violation was intentional and inexcusable. And third, that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation. The district court here made three errors related to two of these factors. First, the district court abused its discretion when it found the evidence was sufficient to prove Mr. Coleman constructively possessed alcohol found in a common area of an apartment. Second, the district court erred when it found Mr. Coleman in violation for accessing an internet device because his conditions did not prohibit having access to such a device. Finally, the district court abused its discretion in its ultimate decision to revoke probation and execute the sentences. For these reasons, we ask you to either outright reverse the revocation of Mr. Coleman's probation and either remand to the district court with instructions to reconsider its decision based on the first two errors, or to reverse and remand with instructions to reinstate Mr. Coleman on probation. Turning first to the first error about possession of alcohol, the district court abused its discretion when it found Mr. Coleman in possession of alcohol. The district court found that Mr. Coleman constructively possessed alcohol found in his four-bedroom apartment given the late hour and that it was found in the kitchen. Now, the district court found that that was constructive possession, but the principles of constructive possession do not support such a conclusion. Constructive possession can be shown in one of two ways. Either it was in an area in which Mr. Coleman was exercising exclusive control to which others did not have access, or if it was found in an area in which others did have access, that at that time he was consciously exercising dominion and control. The general rule for constructive possession is that items found in the common area of an apartment, that's not sufficient to find constructive possession in these cases.
Counsel, can you point us to any case that's similar to this one where an appellate court has found that the evidence wasn't sufficient to find a probation violation where there was constructive possession? The district court found constructive possession, and then on appeal, the appellate court found that the evidence wasn't sufficient to support that probation violation finding.
I do not know of a case in this context with a probation violation, Your Honor. Nevertheless, I think that the principles of constructive possession would still apply in such a situation, because I know, as the state pointed out in its brief, you know, the cases I cite about constructive possession are typically about sufficiency of the evidence. But nevertheless, constructive possession is the analytical framework through which the court considers whether or not there is sufficient evidence. So I think that in a situation like this, we're dealing with a different standard. We're dealing with clear and convincing evidence. But I still think that you would view whether there's clear and convincing evidence through the prism of the constructive possession framework. I think it's...
Is there any evidence in the record to suggest that the other person who was found in the apartment was actually an occupant of the apartment? Because the State v. Lawrence case that you cite talks about occupants and the general rule that's applicable when the defendant is one of two or more occupants of an apartment.
There's, and I'm assuming that by occupants, we're talking about she was a resident of that apartment and not just a social guest.
Correct.
And the evidence, no, there's very little evidence about that other occupant other than she was there. But I still think when we're talking about something like constructive possession for items found in a common area, her presence is relevant to that analysis. I think this would be a different case if it was Mr. Coleman all alone in the apartment. I think this would be a different case if they found the alcohol in Mr. Coleman's bedroom. I think this would be a very different case if, say, that person who was there gave some testimony or spoke to the agents and either said, I saw him drinking alcohol. He invited me over and said, I've got some alcohol in my apartment. Why don't you join me? Frankly, I don't know that it would take all that much to find constructive possession here. But the record as it stands has no evidence directly tying Mr. Coleman to that alcohol. And that's what you need for constructive possession.
What about the evidence relating to the other apartment and the empty beer cans found in the other apartment?
I don't think that that gets us over the hump either for a couple of different reasons. First of all, it wasn't a part of the district court's findings here to support this conclusion. Second of all, we know that Mr. Coleman had drank alcohol before. His agent had testified that he had had an informal violation for use. He admitted to the agent that he had used earlier, and he was informally sanctioned. There was never a formal revocation. So we don't know when he drank that alcohol in the other apartment. That may have been the alcohol he drank then. He was subletting that apartment from someone else. That may have belonged to the previous tenant. Even if we just look at the type of alcohol that was there, the alcohol he was found in violation for constructively possessing are bottles of Mickey's malt liquor, a bottle of Kraken rum, and a bottle of schnapps. What I believe Agent Nelson said was in the other apartment is a bottle of Hennessy cognac and some crushed cans of beer. So it's not even as if he has some sort of favorite brand that you could say, oh, well, he was drinking Hennessy in both apartments, so it's probably reasonable to conclude he had Hennessy in this one. So I don't know that that really factors in or can support the conclusion that he would constructively possess this at all. I think the big reason here, the big problem I have sort of with the district court and why we need some sort of framework for constructive possession is the way that the district court found constructive possession is that it was accessible to Mr. Coleman and he was present. And if that's the definition, then it's really not about possession anymore. Then it starts to get into proximity to alcohol. And due process requires that if lawful conduct can result in a loss of liberty, then that probationer needs to be sufficiently informed. So if Mr. Coleman's mere proximity to alcohol can result in a violation, can result in a loss of his liberty, he needs to be informed. And I think that's another error on the district court's part here. The way that it applied sort of a constructive possession doctrine, I don't know how much of a framework it used, but just by saying that it was accessible and he was present, again, that's really very different concept from possession. And if that's what he's going to be violated for, then that's what Mr. Coleman needs to be aware of when he's initially placed on probation. Moving along to the second error about the internet device. I think where the district court went wrong here is it sort of conflated the two parts of the condition. Mr. Coleman had, there are two pieces here. He was not allowed to own or operate a device that allowed for internet capabilities. And he was not allowed to access the internet. The district court found that with most of these phones, there was no evidence that he was operating them. But how it found a violation was that he knew the code for a tablet. And therefore, according to the district court, he had access to that tablet and he was in possession of that tablet. Having access to a tablet or having possession of it are very different from owning or operating a device. If we were all in a courtroom together, I could take my cell phone and I could tell you my code, 1, 2, 3, 4, and put it up on the bench. And in theory, any one of you would then have access to it. But none of you have owned or operated it at that point. And similarly, if any one of you were to then pick up that phone, you would then be in possession of that device. But until you actually start fooling around and entering the code and accessing the internet, you haven't owned or operated at that point.
Isn't there enough to infer that he operated it, though, given that it's his tablet, he knows the code, it was found in his bedroom?
I think that shows possession. And I think that shows he knew how to access it. It doesn't show that he operated it. And the evidence here, there was very little evidence really about this tablet in general. I think the only thing that came in was in cross-examination when defense counsel said he gave you the code for a tablet. So there is no evidence before the district court to conclude that that tablet actually had internet access and that he was accessing the internet through that tablet. You can have a tablet that doesn't have internet access. And as long as they didn't show that he owned or operated it, then the evidence would be insufficient. And again, the district court said there's not enough here to show owned and operated most of these devices. It rested its decision on this point on access to the device and possession of the device. But given that the evidence didn't show that he owned or operated that tablet, and it didn't show that he accessed the internet, again, the district court abused its discretion in finding that there was sufficient evidence here for violation.
Just have one more question for you related to that. Sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the probation violation report suggests that the tablet was internet capable and was being used to access the internet. And I assume that report was part of the record before the district court when it made its decision to revoke probation. Is that accurate?
I believe it's not accurate, Your Honor. I believe on page 23, and I will just double check because I have the transcript right here. They're talking about, I think, one of the emails, and the defense counsel asks how they're treating them, and the court says, it's part of the violation report. Other than that, I don't have access. They're just part of the report. They're not part of the record as far as the contested hearing, other than they're in the report. So I think we actually have the district court saying that these things aren't actually part of the record in this case. So if the state wanted to prove violation, again, the reports are just to provide notice. You know, they're to certify the rights, but the evidence that comes in to show violation is supposed to come in through the hearing. So if that evidence, which, you know, I'll acknowledge is in the report, if the state wanted to prove a violation based on that, then the state needed to elicit that evidence from either Agent Nelson or Agent Wood, but the state didn't. The state didn't elicit anything about the tablet. It was actually defense counsel who acknowledged that he gave the password that he knew. So again, I don't think that there's sufficient evidence on that to find a violation either.
Okay, thank you. I'll go back and look at the transcript on that. So, you know, even assuming we were to agree with you getting onto the third Austin factor, moving on to that, even assuming we were to agree with you on, let's say, on the alcohol, that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support constructive possession, you're not disputing, or appellant isn't disputing, the violations relating to failure to report the change of address. Is that correct?
Correct. Those two violations would still remain.
Or failure to report the change of employment.
Correct.
And in looking at the district court's order in its analysis of the third factor, it really is focused on those violations in finding that the need for confinement outweighs, the interest in remaining on probation. Because the court is really seems to be concerned with Mr. Coleman's deception in failing to report the change in address and basically his desire to live on his own terms without oversight and not getting the treatment he needs. And finds that therefore that he's in need of treatment in a correctional facility and that the revocation of the probation is necessary to protect the public from further criminal activity. So it seems to me that, you know, even setting aside the violations that you're focused on, the violations that the court relies on to support revocation of the probation aren't being challenged here. So given that, is there really a need to remand, even if we were to agree with you with regard to, say, the alcohol piece of it?
Yes, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all, again, I can't disagree that it really is focused on the address. At the same time, I think on paragraph 19 on page 7 of its order, the district court is also concerned about the behavior that's going on at these residences. So absolutely, it is concerned that he was not reporting these addresses, but it even says that it's concerned given the presence of alcohol in both apartments. It's reasonable to conclude that Mr. Coleman was hiding this information from his probation officer so he could continue to engage in activity which is prohibited. So I think it's not just the residences alone, it's some of the other activity that the district court found him in violation for, specifically the alcohol. It seems to be a little less concerned about the internet device. So it does factor into that ultimate decision. In addition, the court is talking about how he can only have treatment in prison. That's the only way he's going to get it. That's not supported by the record in this case. He has treatment available. He was discharged from court, but it was discharged from court saying he needed inpatient. It didn't say that he needed to receive inpatient in a correctional consequence. That was about mental health service. Specifically provides that there's inpatient treatment available to him. He's welcome to go back to court for outpatient treatment. And I think significantly in this case, as far as treatment goes, it's not as if Mr. Coleman was skipping treatment and discharge for a lack of participation and a lack of progress. He had a first appointment, he had his intake appointment, he attended that appointment. His next appointment was going to be after he was arrested. I think it was March 1st and he was arrested in February. And so he was still doing that. And that is another key piece of the district court's decision here. I see my time is about to elapse. If the court has no further questions, I'll see you on rebuttal.
Any questions from the panel?
Counsel, this is Judge Kirk. Wouldn't you agree that cases like State versus Fleming and State versus Moot make it pretty clear when you get a downward dispositional departure that you're on a very short leash and we don't look for as dramatic, so to speak, a violation as we might in another case? Seems to me the failure to keep the court and the probation advisor of his address would be more than sufficient to justify a revocation in that circumstance, given that this was a dispositional departure.
I would disagree. I will admit that off the top of my head, I can't remember Fleming or the other case that you cited. But if we go back to Austin, which is really the baseline, what Austin says, there are two things that you want to keep in mind, and that is the offense and then the intervening conduct. And nothing in Austin, in fact, I think, again, this isn't in my brief, but State v. Finch, which is a Supreme Court case about probation, and I think it's actually about a writ of mandamus or prohibition, but says the idea that you got a departure is not a part of the analysis, because it's a dangerous road you start walking down, because then it gets into reflexive reactions. You get two strikes. So I would disagree that the fact that you got a departure means that you sort of get this one chance here. So
that's basically what Moot said, though. This was a last chance and you blew it.
I guess, do you have a cite for Moot? I don't know if it's cited.
You know, I don't on my notes right here, but it's State versus Moot, M-O-O-T. It's a Court of Appeals case, but it was a situation where the court made clear at the time of the sentencing that this was your last chance, you know, and it was a departure, dispositional departure. You should have gone to prison. So of course, there's an indication from the legislature that this is what's supposed to happen in that case. And when you depart, you're going contrary to the legislative intent, in a sense.
I would, if I may just very briefly follow up on that comment, is that be that as it may in Moot, I don't know that the record here has the sentencing court saying, now, Mr. Coleman, I don't want to do a departure. You're on a very short leash. You're only getting this one chance. So perhaps, again, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with Moot. I'll take a quick look at it. But I don't know that we maybe even have the same factual situation given those comments at sentencing that I don't think were made at sentencing in this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your answers. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state in this matter. If I may, I'd like to follow up on Judge Kirk's comments about some probationers being on a very short leash. I think that's correct. I think that Not all probationers are in the same circumstance. People new to the system, I think, are given broader latitude, whereas repeat recidivists like Mr. Coleman, who commit dangerous offenses that risk the public's safety, are looked at a little bit differently. And this is particularly apparent in this case. The psychosexual evaluation that I cite to in my brief points out that Mr. Coleman, in the examiner's opinion, is not amenable to treatment, given his continued lack of ownership and the presence of a significant personality disorder. And Mr. Dolly recommend that if indeed treatment is to be attempted, it would need to occur in a secure environment and be of longer duration. The pre-sentence investigation, the second time around, unanimously staffed this sentence and did not agree with a downward dispositional departure in this case. Of course, the history, as you know, Mr. Coleman was convicted by a jury of this case, and the conviction was vacated after a post-conviction proceeding where Judge Stevens determined that he received ineffective assistance at counsel. That was a hotly contested proceeding in which yours truly argued, you know, that wasn't the case, but that's what Judge Stevens ruled. And so when the parties returned to Judge Stevens and said, well, we've reached an agreement, well, frankly, she kind of held her nose and went ahead with the agreement so as to not put the victim through this. But Mr. Coleman did not present himself as particularly amenable to probation. The offenses here that particularly—
Counsel, just a quick question. Were you precluded from appealing her decision on a new trial?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Why didn't you appeal?
Well, we accepted the court's ruling. It was a close call, and we made a tactical decision to just either retry the case or negotiate an outcome, and that's what we did. But the violations that particularly struck the Judge King, the final sentencing court, you know, was the deceitful nature of Mr. Coleman taking up not one but two different residences, in which Judge King inferred that he was to do so that he could engage in prohibited activities in this environment. And as I point out in my brief, this wasn't just a technical foul. This was felonious behavior. And he was, in fact, and is presently charged for that very conduct, for not registering those addresses. And I think the public does take these registration offenses seriously. Certainly if, you know, Mr. Coleman moved in next door to you or a loved one, it's something people want to know about. And that's why the Guidelines Commission makes those presumptive commit offenses right off the bat. So again, the Judge King found this was not a mere technical violation. With respect to the first arguments about the violations themselves, I think it's important again to recall that Judge King found that Mr. Coleman had in fact taken up residence in these two apartments. On the 16th Avenue apartment, Mr. Coleman was the leaseholder of the apartment, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that there are roommates, co-tenants, other leaseholders in the apartment. This young lady that emerged from Mr. Coleman's bedroom, couldn't even find her name in the proceedings, and there's nothing I could find to suggest that she is anything but a social guest.
Counsel, what do you rely on for that, given that the state had the burden of proof to show a probation violation by clear and convincing evidence? What do you rely on to say that she's nothing more than a social guest?
Well, I think I said there's nothing in the record to suggest anything to the contrary, I guess that's all I can say. There's no
affirmative. So we don't really, the record doesn't reflect one way or the other. Is that accurate?
I'd say that's a fair statement, yes.
But, and so what is the clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Coleman was in constructive possession of the alcohol, that he exercised dominion and control over the alcohol?
Well, I guess I take the position that he's in actual possession of it. This is his apartment, and there's no dispute in that fact at this stage. He is the leaseholder. He does not come to the door when his probation officer knocks on the door. And as I recall, they may have even tried to call. It's 10 o'clock at night and they finally have to gain entry, and out he comes. There happens to be a young lady in his bedroom. But, you know, it'd be one thing if the record below in the testimony was the young lady says, oh, that's my phone, and she took take it, or she took the alcohol. There was, or Mr. Coleman had relayed to his probation agent, oh, I know this, I can see how this looks. This doesn't look good, but let me tell you, none of that's mine. But that's not the facts, and that's not the testimony. There was no claims by Mr. Coleman that there's some logical explanation for all this stuff, or that it's not mine, or
that Mr. Coleman doesn't have the burden of showing that he was not in constructive possession. The state has the obligation to prove that at the hearing.
Yes. I'm just saying that the testimony provided was, you know, there was no claim to the contrary that when they entered his apartment at 10 p.m., that this was just a misunderstanding. Mr. Coleman, to his credit, gave no excuses or other, you know, I'm just saying that's the testimony that was listed here, that there was an absence of any claim that it belonged to somebody else. We can't prove a negative, but we, you know, the testimony was we came in, there was this, you know, the phones, the tablet, the alcohol, and there was no other explanation presented other than here it is. And as to a common area, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Well, again, I take issue with this notion that this isn't, there's no evidence that we have that there was other people living in this apartment, and this notion of a common area, I guess, considering the lease and the circumstances, this appears to be Mr. Coleman's apartment. And again, there's logical inferences that can be drawn from this evidence. And I think that's what the district court did. And I don't think that is against logic. I don't think it's an abuse of discretion to draw those inferences with the record we have here. I mean, you could make the argument that it's not mine, it's hers, but that's not what Judge King found. And we're here to determine whether that's clearly erroneous. So, as to the internet access issue, I just think it's a sort of a hyperextension of the terms of his probation. And Mr. Coleman's just not supposed to have these things. He's allowed one internet capable device that has monitoring software on it. So, you know, he's not supposed to have these things, and it's not an unfair inference that he's using them to access the internet. It reminds me of, you know, former President Clinton, who admitted he may have smoked marijuana when he was in college, but he didn't inhale. I mean, it's not only implausible, but it seems to be a distinction without substance. Why else would someone have a tablet like these devices plugged in, charging, having a code to the device if they're not accessing the internet? There was evidence in the record that he was using some device. Actually, it was his monitor phone. Never mind, I'll withdraw that. The one that had the monitoring, they were monitoring that for his orders for the food.
Counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument that possession is different than owning, and that the terms needed to be more clear if mere possession was going to be sufficient for a probation violation?
Well, I guess I disagree with the idea that you have to go out and find the subscription, who's the, you know, get a search warrant to Verizon to find out who's the subscriber to the phone. He's on felony probation. He's not supposed to have these devices to begin with, other than the one phone that's authorized for him. So I guess possession is 9/10 of the law. He's the king of his castle, and everything in his kingdom here falls within his domain, and he exercises his dominion and control over those things in his apartment. And I just think the record here does not reflect a situation with multiple people having access to this sort of thing, other than a suggestion without any direct evidence in the record that, well, maybe it belongs to this young lady. I think if that were the case, it would have been fleshed out by the two probation agents who entered the apartment and were exploring this. I think if there were concerns that it belonged to somebody else, they would have fleshed that out. That's just not the evidence we have in the record.
Would you agree that the probation violation report is not part of was not part of the record before the district court at the hearing, the revocation hearing?
Well, I guess I would agree with Mr. Donovan that, you know, the state needs to present evidence. I think it's part of the record. It's in the record. It's in the court file. And
there wasn't any testimony, though, by the officers as to what was the details of what was in the probation violation reports regarding whether the tablet was being used to access the internet.
I'd have to refresh my recollection of the transcript itself, but I mean, I think I agree with Mr. Donovan to the extent that the probation violation report provides notice of that. It is part of the record, yes. And I think it frames the question for the court. Does that answer the court's question?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, look, I just, this the state's position here that it met its burden with respect to showing that Mr. Coleman was at the very least putting himself in a situation where his apartment contains various forms of contraband that he's not supposed to access. Even if it was left behind by some former occupant, I don't think it's an excuse to not throw it away. I think he has to divest himself of these things, and he can't be in even constructive possession of it, if that's what this is. But our position is the court found this is his apartment. The things are there, and he has dominion and control over them. And whether you call it actual or constructive, I think it's sufficient for our purposes here that he's not in compliance with what the sentencing judge ordered. So with that,
in regard to the third Austin factor, does the court's analysis depend on the probation violations relating to alcohol and the tablet, or are the findings relating to failing to report his address and change of?
The center of gravity for the third Austin factor is these apartments. Now, even if this contraband did not belong to him and it belonged to party guests or other people who had entered his apartment, nevertheless, he's deceiving his probation agent. He's committing felonies for each of those apartments, and he's putting himself in reaching distance of contraband that he's not supposed to have. So I think that Judge King was pretty clear about a concern about his deceitful choices. Again, for a person who really wasn't amenable to probation in the first place for a dispositional departure, and a person who's deemed not amenable to treatment, and if so, it should be in a custodial setting. So when he demonstrates this very deliberate attempt to evade supervision, I think that Judge King's decision to revoke probation is supported by the record and is not an abuse of discretion. Unless the court has any additional questions for me, I'll remit the balance of my time.
Counsel, am I mistaken, but didn't you agree to an offered plea and agree to recommend a downward disposition?
Yes.
Okay.
Not me, but yes, the state certainly did.
Sorry, any further questions from the panel?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Sure. Thank you for your answers. All right. And with that, counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a couple of very quick points. One, I think Judge Kirk, maybe I'll pick up having a chance to very briefly skim Moot and Fleming. I think the situation here is certainly very different from Moot, at least. I mean, Moot says, here the record is clear at sentencing that the trial judge made a downward dispositional departure for the sole reason of affording appellant one last opportunity to succeed in treatment of chemical dependency. He was told on the record and in writing that he must successfully complete treatment and recommended aftercare. He'd been through treatment, so he was aware of what was required of him. He took a job that interfered with that schedule and was frustrated with that program. I don't know that we have necessarily the same thing here. Or even Fleming talks about, you know, citing to Moot again, you can consider it. I still disagree. I think that Austin is pretty clear that it's the basis of the original offense and the intervening conduct. regardless, I don't think we have the same sort of sentencing scenario as was present in Moot, nor do I think that Judge King in this case was necessarily relying on that departure so much here either. Just to briefly touch on the internet device, I don't know that it would have been as impossible as the state is making it sound to determine whether or not Mr. Coleman was accessing this device. I don't know that you have to get a Verizon warrant to search them. I think you could have done what they sort of seemingly did. Again, that's not part of the record at the hearing, on looking through it and going through that tablet that he provided the code for to determine whether or not he was accessing the internet, whether or not it had access to the internet at all, or anything like that. This was I'm not quite sure if the state amended this. There was an Android phone charging in the kitchen. I believe that was the phone that he was authorized to use and not the tablet. I believe the tablet was one of the devices found in the back bedroom. 9/10 of the law is a fun thing to say when you're disagreeing with someone. It's very different to say that possession is 9/10 of the law when someone has 117 months in prison hanging over their head and their conditions don't say possession. Their conditions say own and their conditions say operate. So unless the court has any further questions, we would ask you to reverse and remand with either instructions to reconsider the decision or instructions to reinstate Mr. Coleman on probation.
Just to follow up on the two cases, I think they both point out the Minnesota sentencing guidelines themselves indicate that there's less judicial tolerance in probation proceedings for more serious crimes, and certainly criminal sexual conduct is a serious crime.
I would agree with that. But again, I don't think he got the same warning, nor do I think that the departure necessarily factored in. The court had other tools. If the court is concerned about where he is, GPS is the perfect tool to know where Mr. Coleman is. We could have started there. He had a lot of change he was going to need to make. And we're not disputing, I don't think anyone disputes that he had a lot of change he needed to make, and change was going to be slow. But there were tools available to the court. Revocation, again, Austin and Motlin say, that is to be the last resort. And I don't think that the district court here properly used the tools before going to that last resort. Thank you.
All right, thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. And thank you for appearing by Zoom. That concludes this oral argument. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.